Ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to start off our final quarter of the program. We've got three fine speakers here this afternoon. We'll be talking about oceans and fisheries. And I have to say that both those topics often get far less attention than they deserve. And so, especially given fisheries, and its importance for livelihoods and for income. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Meg Keane, who's a Senior Policy Fellow at the ANU College of Asia and the Pacific and former Senior Analyst at ONA. Meg, if you could...
Come on, I feel like a giant. Okay, thank you very much. I've been asked to give a bit of an overview. So I'm going to start with the local, the food security and livelihoods in the Pacific, and particularly the coastal fisheries. And then I'll say a few words about offshore fisheries as well, and then we'll just see where the conversation takes us in the discussion time. I'm going to draw on, and I've put it outside for anybody who's interested in this area. We had a joint ANU, University of South Pacific, workshop on ocean governance in the run-up to the June UN summit on oceans. And so some of these issues or concerns are taken from them and some of the thinking as well. I want to start with coastal fisheries because I think sometimes the smaller scales matter more than the larger scales, and the invisible just gets missed. Coastal fisheries are incredibly important in the Pacific. They produce about 50 to 90% of the protein for most communities. PNG is a bit of an exception, but the island communities. There are fisheries in the South Pacific and in Melanesia in particular are under mounting pressure, and I imagine you've sort of elaborated on this in the morning, but it's not only population growth and climate change and land uses that spill into the ocean, but it's also a changing demographic which we often don't take account of in Melanesia. Yes, 70-80% of the people live in rural areas, but it is a very rapidly urbanizing place. So the rates of urbanization in Melanesia rival those of anywhere around the world. So in a place like Honiara, 4.7% growth rates. When we look at what's happening in the coastal fisheries around these settlement areas, we see degradation of the coastal fisheries. The predictions are, and I think you're working to the white paper, so we'll say by 2030, the productivity or the biomass coming out of coastal fisheries is going to decline. So we've got increasing demand, we've got increasing people, and we've got productivity or the outputs from these areas going down. And so that's going to matter. That's going to matter for people's lives, for their livelihoods, and for their capacity to look after themselves. And really, it's been recently that regional attention is putting a brighter light on coastal fisheries and what can be done. But the most recent report card from the Pacific Community and FFA really highlights that social and ecological resilience in Melanesia in coastal fisheries is under a lot of pressure, and that's because we don't know what's going on. In part, the data is missing. It's hard to manage when you don't know extraction rates, health, even how it's being managed. But it's also hard to work with these coastal communities if you don't have good connectivity between the local to the national. Coastal communities are, the coastal resources are mainly under customary marine tenure. So you can't just put over laws and regulations about what those landowners are going to do. They're going to have to be working in partnership. And that connectivity isn't working particularly well. It's pretty well recognized that the central agencies that are charged with fisheries management really lack the reach, the capacity, in some cases the jurisdiction to really help in these areas. So that's the critical analysis, but I think there is some good news in this, and we can build on what is there. The Pacific is a leader with locally managed marine areas, so the working at the local area to manage the resources. Fiji's probably the leader in this. With respect to the locally managed marine areas, they cover about 70% of the coastal areas. Much better outcomes and sustainability could occur if they were better networked together and if they were better networked into central agencies and if we exported the Fijian model of better support, scientific support, help with community-based monitoring so the system is more responsive, and linking in to government agencies. Development assistance is often top-down rather than bottom-up, and I think with fisheries and coastal fisheries, top-down is always going to be quite problematic, whereas if we start to build from the bottom up, there's a lot more potential there with integration. Ultimately, we're going to have to relieve some of the pressure, and that's going to be looking at alternatives. So fisheries are there to feed the people. There might have to be different ways of trying to feed them by adding value to the fisheries products and assets. The problem with this in the Pacific is if we turn to tourism or resource extraction, seabed mining, and the alike, we've got problems with the resource curse, we've got problems with equity, and how that the value of those goods will be distributed and how much the community itself will benefit. So that kind of diversification of livelihoods that we look at has to be done pretty carefully if we're not going to add to poverty and inequity problems. There are some really positive signs about getting better integration and coordination across agencies, because once you start to diversify, you've got multiple uses and people have to be coordinated. I think in work I do in Solomon Islands with the group there that is developing a national oceans policy, they've recognized that one agency is not talking to the other to the detriment of the sustainable management of coastal and indeed offshore resources. So in developing it, they've got an Ocean 12 group, which is 12 different agencies trying to come together about priorities and strategies for oceans. Sticking point with that is it's currently being funded by IUCN. That funding will likely come to the end in about a year's time. So who's going to support them to keep this going and get this kind of integrated management strong and to actually get it implemented rather than just speaking about how it can be done? These issues of integration, partnerships, and equity of harvesting a resource come to the fore when we talk about offshore fisheries, the tuna fisheries. I think, again, we need to recognize when we talk about security and national security or economic security, the Pacific has done an excellent job with its management of tuna fisheries. That doesn't mean there's not pressures, but the parties to the Nauru Agreement, which I think I heard mentioned, but basically the 8 tuna-rich nations have come together and basically limited access to the resource through the Vessel Day scheme. And that, over the last 6 years, has boosted returns to island countries by about 500%. Even so, when we talk to them about the tuna resource, there's a real concern that they're not in control, that most of the benefits still flow overseas. About 80 or 90% of the commercial catch is still done by foreign-owned vessels. So there's a thought of how do we get more value added out of this. But it's looking at these long-term projections about climate change, et cetera. We have to take into account what is your development pathway. There's a lot of canneries. They're talking about more and more canneries in the Pacific. But the tuna resource itself in the next out to 2050 is likely to decline by 5 to 10%. And possibly more so in Melanesia, because of the way the climate change will occur and the warming of the water, the fish are going to move to the north and the east. So that's good if you're in American Pacific. But in the Melanesian countries, you might even have fewer available to you. The stock may shift, as well as the pressure on it from distant water fishing nations bringing the stock down. So is a cannery in PNG or another one in Solomon Islands really a good idea in the long term? Does that mean I have 2 minutes or I'm finished?
2 minutes.
Okay. So I got that right. And the pressures will build. I mean, at the moment, it is quite a well-managed tuna fishery. So about 35% of the world's tuna comes from the Pacific Island or the West and Central Pacific area. But what that means, and we can track it, is more and more are coming into that area. And I think as one of our speakers is going to talk about, if you don't have good surveillance, if you don't have good monitoring of what's going on in those waters, the losses can be big. So at the moment, the FFA last year estimated that $616 million US was being lost through illegal, unreported, or unregulated fishing. That's more than the aid that we give to Papua New Guinea every year. So that is not a small amount of money, and it can be used extremely well if it wasn't flowing out. The only way I think that this can be, well, the monitoring can be done and surveillance can be improved is through partnerships, and there's a real role for Australia, and that's going to assist our national security, our marine areas abut each other, as well as the national security of these countries and the development prospects of these countries. So it's about how we work together, and I think there's a positive story there. We'll hear about how defense cooperation and Quads Plus are occurring, but we also have trilateral aid where people are collaborating on aid projects in the Pacific, and that includes China. And we also have a push by the Pacific to put sustainable development goals for oceans on the international agenda. It will be very interesting to see the support they're going to get from their development partners to make that real, to implement, and to support them in that initiative. And there's a real opportunity, I think, for Australia and others to help them make the most of that possibility in June and beyond. Integrated oceans management, we are fairly good at that in Australia, and there's a lot of support that could be given, both technical, but also just in that exchange of ideas, training, etc. And we heard just in this last session about capacity building. The problem is if you do too much of that at the core, it's not going to necessarily flow out to where it's really needed in the provincial area. So we, I think, have to think about the models we're using. So the fisheries, if they go neglected, they're certainly going to be big local and national security issues. And if we engage well, that's going to be good for our development engagement as well as the security of the region. So there's real opportunities there, not all of which have been harvested at this time. So I think I'll leave it there.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. And if I could ask Judy, if you'd like to give Judy Swan, who's with Director with Pacific Islands and Maritime Security, Pacific and Timor-Leste Branch, Department of Defence. I think Judy's got a PowerPoint.
This is very cool. Hi everyone, hi, I'm Judy Swan from Pacific Islands and Maritime Security section of Defence. We come under International Policy Division and under the Pacific and Timor-Leste Branch. So I guess to start, the links between defence and fisheries is reasonably tenuous, but it all comes down to the Defence White Paper and what is in our national security interests. So obviously, 2016 Defence White Paper was released in April of last year and talked about a few key strategic interests and a few key strategic objectives. If you haven't had an opportunity to look at it, it's certainly available on the website. We talk about a secure nearer region, a secure nearer region and the maritime security in our northern approaches and in the South Pacific. The aim of our Defence White Paper in that regard was to build the security and stability of the region, as was mentioned before, it protects the security and stability of the Pacific Island countries themselves, but also ultimately builds the security and presence that Australia has in the region as a security partner of choice. That language is used in the White Paper. That's what we seek to try and be, the security partner of choice for Pacific Island countries in Papua New Guinea and Timor-Leste. Okay, so the way we do that is through the Defence Cooperation Program. So the Defence Cooperation Program began in around the 1960s. It's a significant investment in the security and stability of the region and of Southeast Asia. In the Pacific alone, we spent $79 million last financial year. So that's a significant investment in the Pacific Island countries and our Pacific partners. The Defence Cooperation Program is exactly that. It's similar to an aid program, and it's run through a grassroots but also top-down approach in that we identify projects and things that we can be doing in the region. the DCP tends to focus on some key areas. Building capacity in leadership and training is a particularly big one. We have a very big training program. We also have strong people-to-people links, and we build tactical and operational support through training and exercises and support to capability. I just want to try and run through some of this. Sorry, this might not be as interesting to you until we come to the big one, which I can try and get to. Military secondments, I'm just going to run through some of this until we get to the actual patrol boats, but military secondments, training and exercises are our big ones, I guess, in terms of the big costs and training exercises. And the Defence Cooperation Program, as I said, for in our region was around $79 million last year. And in the countries that I look after, which is everything but Papua New Guinea, Timor-Leste, that came to around $14 million in cash project support, and around $30 million for the boats that we provide. That's just for 1 year. And just come to the Pacific Patrol Boat Program. The biggest component of the Defence Cooperation Program is a project which we have called the Pacific Patrol Boat Program. It began in 1987. We gifted 22 patrol boats to 12 countries in the Pacific. We've gifted them as brand new assets in 1987. I think it took around 10 years to roll that program out. They are their own sovereign assets. We don't task those patrol boats. We've gifted those patrol boats as sovereign assets to the nations. What we do provide, though, is a very comprehensive package of support that includes maintenance. So we fully maintain those vessels every 7 years through a full refit. The boats themselves were supposed to last for 15 years. They've now lasted for nearly 30 years. So we've done extensive repairs and maintenance and refit on those vessels. And every few years, those countries do their own slippings to them. We also provide a lot of the fuel, I would say nearly the majority of the fuel that the boats require, and even food, every possible thing that could be related to that patrol boat is probably funded through Australia. The only thing we don't fund, of course, is the wages for the crews themselves, which are normally police crews, because 9 of the 12 countries that we support are police countries with the patrol boats. Only 3 of them are military run, so that's Tonga, Fiji and Papua New Guinea. This slide shows some of the EEZs these cover. You've probably already seen this. I'm sorry, I don't know the program. I haven't followed the program closely. But you can see the extensive economic exclusive zones that these countries try and provide surveillance over. It's beyond the capacity of one boat in a lot of countries. Some countries have been gifted up to 3 boats. Fiji, for example, has 3 boats. Whereas Kiribati and Micronesian Islands have 1 boat, so it's obviously not enough. But it's the best that we can provide, and their patrol boats are very sort of gratefully received by the nations. When we go out there, they literally, and some nations trip over themselves thanking us for the patrol boat. They're really, really appreciative of it. The Pacific patrol boats, though, aren't used just only for fishing and surveillance. They're also used for a range of law enforcement opportunities, including boardings, mostly fishery crime, some non-fishery crime. Certainly also used for HADR support and the provision of supplies during post-cyclones and that sort of thing. The islands often help each other out, so we had Tongan patrol boats going to Fiji after post-cyclone, after Cyclone Winston, which was great. Again, with Australian-funded fuel, but it was an opportunity for them to work together and support each other. And they're also used for medical transport and evacuation, which is important. I'll come back to that later. We also provide extensive support to the Foreign Fisheries Agency. So whereas DFAT and Agriculture provide the core and project funding for the FFA, we provide a military seconded officer as the surveillance operations officer in the FFA, and so does New Zealand. So there are 2 military personnel sitting in the Regional Fisheries Surveillance Centre. We've also fully refurbished the RFSC. It was a couple of $100,000 last year. A lot of the equipment has been purchased by Defence. And of course, we fully fund their 4 operations every year. So the 4 FFA operations that are held each year, multilateral operations, are fully funded by Australian Department of Defence in terms of fuel, victuals, We fund the watch keepers that go from country to FFA to provide that service. And we also, apart from the cash that we provide to the FFA for that support, we obviously also provide significant military support through the Quad surveillance efforts. So that's boats, military aircraft, a whole lot of activity goes on under Operational Solania. That's just for Australia. Obviously New Zealand, France and the US also support that, those operations. So the support to surveillance has been extensive from the Department of Defence. Not to undermine the most important aspect of that is we actually have two naval personnel living in each of those countries where there is a patrol boat. We have a lieutenant commander and a chief petty officer living in those countries. They are advisors to the nations. They're not part of the crew, but they provide maintenance and technical advice for countries which are sorely lacking in technical expertise when it comes to this sort of maritime platform. So those boats are getting a little bit old. They're 30 years old now. The last refit for the, a couple of the boats now, the Micronesian boat and the Vanuatu boat, where the refit costs are in the vicinity of $8 million. We budget for $3 million. So these boats are becoming increasingly expensive to maintain. In June 2015, the Australian Government agreed to the Pacific Maritime Security Program, which is now the natural follow-on from the patrol boat program. Under this program, all of the patrol boats will be replaced. That's the first key element of that. So the Pacific patrol boats will be replaced with a Guardian-class patrol boat. I'm going to run a little bit over time, but I'm going to go through. The Guardian-class patrol boats, we've just named them that specifically so that we could refer to the PPBs, which are going to be in the region and pulled out over the next 5 years, and the GPBs, which are going to be coming into the region. So we'll have two separate platforms in the area at the same time. The GPBs, we'll have a few less of them. We've agreed to build 19 of them at the moment. There are obviously, as I said before, 22, so some nations will get, some nations with three boats will get only two boats, and I'll come to why in a minute. And then, of course, we're offering two boats to Timor-Leste, and they're yet to respond, but we're hopeful that they will pick up that offer. The Pacific Maritime Security Program also includes two elements that haven't previously been included, and I'll come to those shortly. The next few slides, I'm happy to send this to anyone, and I apologise for going so quickly through it, focuses on the boat's capability. The boats are much, much, much bigger. They're 10 metres longer, 1.5 times the displacement. They have a 1.5 tonne crane on the back for loading HODR supplies, 1,600 square metre cargo hold for keeping HODR supplies. They have a contained quarantined air supply medical room so that people with communicable diseases can be transferred into Ireland as well. These boats are built on our current Bay and Cape class vessels that Australia uses for its own purposes, for EEZ surveillance. So I won't go into the details, but this is sort of what the boat looks like, the new boats look like. And the next few slides show some of the decks. Most importantly, in this slide here, you can see the rib, I think it's called, baby boat, that's what we call it, that comes out the back, which is much easier than sort of craning it off the side. So there's a whole lot of new technologies. It will have electric charting, it will have satellite imagery. We need to do extensive work with the crews of these patrol boats over the next 5 years to get them ready to use this. They will sail their old boat across to Cairns, they'll be flown over to Perth, pick up the new boat and sail around Australia back to home again. So this is a huge project.
What happens to the old boats?
We're scrapping them. I'm not telling all of the pigs that though, we're telling them we're environmentally disposing of them because they are pretty emotionally attached to them. And they would like to keep some of them.
Why not?
Well, we can't afford it, to be honest. They're just literally breaking us, the old boats. But really, state-of-the-art navigation and communication as well, so that's another sort of area of training we have to do. These are designed for military and police requirements. They've also had anthropomorphic studies done on them so that the toilets and beds for the Tongans are a little bit bigger than the toilets and beds for the Micronesians. Things like that are really important out there. And lots of activity for enforcement and HADR capability. Enforcement in particular because we would like these boats to go broader than fisheries.
And I guess that's where the sort of PMSP is coming from. I'll come to that in a second. Second largest part of the PMSP is the integrated aerial surveillance. So this is something we've never done before. The VMS and AIS data that the FFA sees neglects probably the biggest part of the illegal fisheries component, and that's dark targets. The only way to see dark targets is through an aerial platform. Defence will fund aerial surveillance over the Pacific, $15 million a year for the next 30 years. We will contract a civilian aircraft platform to do that. We will fund it, and we will ask the FFA to manage that and give them operational control. We hope that the planes will have FFA livery on the side of them, so we absolutely want them to have nothing to do with defence, but we know that they will be up in the air and they will see illegal fishing information. They'll also see a lot of non-fishing illegal boat activities. We want that information to go to the Pacific Transnational Crime Coordination Centre, the PTCCC. So the aim of the PMSP is to look at illegal fishing activity, but to go broader as well and look at illegal people movements and other transnational crime. This is a really big area for the Pacific, one they're not overly comfortable with, so we're focusing on fishing for the next 3 or 4 years. And the last aspect of the PMSP is enhanced regional coordination. So this is a small bucket of money that we're going to keep aside for satellite communication, increased fuel for multilateral operations, anything really that can come under that enhanced regional coordination tag. We'll include information flowing, if we can, between the PTCCC and the FFA to increase that security picture that we can build. Sorry that was so fast. Again, I can provide you with a copy of the slide very easily. It's all unclassified, and hopefully that sort of shows you what Defence is doing to add to that sort of monitoring and control and surveillance picture.
Just invite our final speaker, Brooke Campbell, who's a research fellow with the Fisheries Governance Research Program, Australian National Centre for Ocean Resources and Security, down at the University of Wollongong.
And it seems as though I should have tic-tacked with Meg a little bit more. but on the plus side, your last talk of the day will be slightly shorter than anticipated. However, I will be delving a little bit more into the food security dimensions of fisheries in the Pacific. But I will start with a really broad overview and maybe sort of flesh out some of the general topics that Meg presented. So my numbers are slightly different. I've got 60% of the world tuna comes from WCPO. I think when you tally it up and see what comes through Thailand and then gets redistributed, it's actually quite a bit larger than 35%. But it would be interesting to go back and check and see. It's a large amount of tuna that the world consumes comes from this region, regardless. And when we're talking about fisheries in the Pacific, we're not just talking about one thing. I mean, the agriculture people in the room will know, agriculture is not just one blanket term. It actually encompasses a lot of different components. And fisheries is no different. You have your what are typically called offshore or oceanic fisheries. We have your coastal fisheries, and we also have aquaculture. And in the Pacific, these play very different roles. My brain was going there. So the world's largest tuna fisheries is actually incredibly lucrative, and it's still one of the more richest and most productive fisheries in the world. So the tuna stocks are still actually doing pretty well, with the exception of the specific ones. And they're worth about $5.7 billion. And 2.8 million tons of fish were caught in the Western and Central Pacific Ocean in 2014. So as this little pie chart diagram below show you here, that's actually a major component of Pacific Island revenue. So because unusually to the rest of the world, a lot of these fisheries actually happen within the exclusive economic zones of Pacific Island developing countries, a lot of these bilateral and multilateral access rights arrangements can be negotiated, and that returns a lot of money to Pacific Island economies. So it's an incredibly important part of government operating revenues in the region. It also brings in a fair amount of money for exports. So the tuna fisheries in the region are heavily export-oriented to markets in the EU and Japan. But as we're sort of seeing as we're progressing along this pie chart to the right here, this is where coastal fisheries sort of start to kick in, and these are the lower value, lower economic value fisheries, but they actually contribute an enormous part to the gross domestic product of a lot of these countries. Papua New Guinea is a slight exception to this. And they contribute an almost inestimable amount to the local local population's nutrition. So as Meg had mentioned, fisheries provide about 50 to 90% of the animal protein in these coastal communities. In contrast, the fish consumption, the average global fish consumption is probably at around 20% now. So it's incredibly high. Over 50% of the coastal communities derive their first or second source of income from coastal fisheries. In this last little, one of the regional studies that's been done in 2009 hasn't really been updated since then, but I think it's largely still current for a lot of reasons, is that about 75% of these Pacific Island countries are not estimated to be able to meet their fish food protein needs by 2030. And these are very rough estimates based on things like coral reef productivity in the face of climate change, current capture fisheries patterns, overfishing, the types of governance and management that is going on in the region, and growing populations, changing trends in urbanization, and distribution flows. And Melanesian countries, with the exception, I think, of New Caledonia, are all within this 75% category. So there's a lot of sort of difficult decisions that are going to need to be made in a relatively short frame of time. So just sort of touching on the food security dimensions of how we're going to address this, it's not just about availability, as was brought up a little bit in one of the presentations in the morning. Where will fish supply come from? This seems really basic, but it's, as everyone knows, once you start to unravel the threads, it becomes a lot more complicated. Do we ramp up domestic supply of fish? Well, we know that coastal fisheries, which provide the vast majority of the daily animal food protein requirements, are more or less at capacity in a lot of countries. Do we do imports and substitutions? Well, we know that household income is a bit of a challenge, especially in places like inland Melanesia. You've got issues like distribution challenges and household income. So you can't just tell people to go out and buy a can of tuna. It's not that easy. There's been some suggestions put forth that we focus a little bit more on assisting Pacific Island nations in returning some of the benefits from tuna fisheries. Is more of that cash then retained in country? Or do we pump in a lot of effort into expanding fish aggregating device programs where you're attracting a lot more of the offshore fisheries, pelagic fisheries, so they're easier to access for smaller vessels or artisanal vessels? So that's one consideration. There's a host of other sort of policy implications that might go into it, but that's one of the ideas that's being thrown around at the moment that for some countries could help meet the projected supply gap. Especially in urbanized areas, if you throw out a fish aggregating device and attract fish that don't normally aggregate in a coastal area, you could be providing a much larger food source than would otherwise would be possible. There's also the consideration of aquaculture. There's been various attempts to kickstart aquaculture since the 1970s in the Pacific with varying degrees of success. By and large, the most successful ones have been income generating, not so much food generating. There's some examples in Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands about tilapia, but by and large, we're not seeing those large quantities of domestically retained food. There's also the issue where a lot of these aquaculture programs were project driven, and so that initial feasibility analysis phase was sort of skipped. It was more of a, let's see if this is actually technically possible, let's train some people, let's see how it works, but actually seeing whether or not there was a market sort of came after the fact. And so in some of these cases, you had this aquaculture extension service set up, but there just was no local market, there was no interest. Because for some people, a fish is not a fish. It really depends on what you're familiar with and what you're comfortable with. So it's not just about supply here, it's also about access. The definition that we're seeing with food security is access to all people. So it's not just the haves, but it's also including the have-nots. So how are we going to get this fish to people? We've got issues from rural distribution centers where a lot of the rural communities are actually their fisheries may still be okay, but you've got urban migration. So, for example, in Kiribati, where they're projected to be able to meet food security demands, except for the fact that the majority of their population all lives in Tarawa, you've got a distribution issue. You've got 33 small islands, not all of which are inhabited, but you have a large amount of fish, but no way of getting it to the main population center. And so that's just one example in terms of the same with inland Papua New Guinea. How are you going to get fish there? It's a possibility, but the practical logistical dimensions of those are quite challenging. And then you've also got the issue of household income. So even if you do have technical access, if you're unable to purchase, that kind of limits your options. More and more, we're seeing less of an explicit focus specifically only on supply. We're actually now starting to think about, well, how are people using fish? So is it enough to just, someone has a can of tuna, their basic protein needs are met, but what are the sort of health implications of that? In the Pacific, we're seeing this, an emerging sort of focus on the double burden of disease, where you've got infant malnutrition and adulthood obesity, and where does fish play into that system? Fresh fish is incredibly nutritious, but there you require the supply systems you require the refrigeration systems, you require the transport systems. There's a lot of support systems that need to go into place to be able to support this type of consumption. And if you are smoking or boiling or salting your fish, you may be getting your protein needs, but it has your salt and hypertension risk just shot through the roof. So there's these balancing factors that are also need to be considered when you're talking about how to resolve these food security challenges around fish in the Pacific. And finally, I would also suggest that these three dimensions are also underpinned by a dimension of stability. So what sort of policies and management practices are going to secure the sustainable fish supply through time? So how are you going to reduce and manage this vulnerability? So it's not just about having supply today. What are you doing to make sure that there's supply in 10, 20, 30 years? And I know I'm preaching to the choir on this one, but it's actually really surprising that I think that agriculture and terrestrial systems are a little bit ahead of the game when it comes to coming up with integrated solutions. So fisheries is really only just starting to realize that there needs to be more talking and more integration. So it's not just fisheries people talking to fisheries people. There's people talking, fisheries people talking in environment, talking to people in agriculture, talking to people in health, and really pulling together these systems because food security isn't just a fisheries issue in the Pacific. It's a whole of island and whole of government issue. And again, the context-dependent nature of things, again, it seems like it's really obvious, but you'd be surprised at the number of times that people show up as this blanket intervention that they're really expecting to work. And it's sort of time to temper these sort of broadcast ideas with a bit more local context. I think I'll just sort of leave it at that. Thanks very much.
So in keeping with our previous sessions, I'll throw to the floor and ask for comments and reflections. And then just at the end, I'll ask each of our three speakers just to give a quick sort of wrap up. Over to you, the floor.
The question. The word satellite surveillance came in one single presentation. Is there not an enormous potential for satellite surveillance of the oceans that is not currently accessible to the islands?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you were going to run a surveillance program from Australia over the Pacific, you wouldn't do it the way we're doing it, for sure, with giving them patrol boats and that sort of thing. Our interest, the Defence's interest, is in engagement. We need to engage those countries. We need to have them see us as the security partner of choice. So we need plans, landing, and people talking, and that sort of thing. So satellite imagery, for sure, we'll be using that.
The extent to which we can use that is still a bit unclear because it'll rely a lot on what the RFSC is capable of receiving and analysing and then retasking. But our primary focus at the moment is on the contracted civilian planes because we need to engage with the countries and their officials.
Other issues with the capacity to analyse that data, is that what you're saying about the capacity?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a big data book.
Yeah, so we have, I neglected to mention the PMSP is $2 billion over the next 30 years. The aerial surveillance line, as I said, is $15 million. We expect to get a prime contractor who would be able to do that, but we're going to be asking the prime contractor to support the RFSC with probably contracted officers to help build that analytical capacity and simply build their ability in-house to analyse information that comes through, to task.
I make that point because the Corporate Fund Parliamentary Conference this year, it's currently titled Big Data and Small Farmers or something like that, but we mustn't forget to include small fishers.
And right now a lot of the data that's been collected is not being coded and analysed.
Yeah.
From the boats alone, let alone when other information comes in. So it is a really big issue in these places of what can you analyse and act upon.
Could someone give us a 10-minute case study on that for the conference?
That would be you more than I would imagine. And then we have a colleague who's worked on there's all sorts of, around this big data, there's a lot of information, and I know Quinton Hanich does a lot on the fact that we have a ton of information, but it's not well analyzed. There's commercial incompetence, which makes no sense because you can download it from Google Earth anyway, but it does mean that really simple solutions with pre-existing data sets are not being maximized used. So we can add in more and more, or we can slow down and say, how do we analyze? What's the system capable of? And anyway, what do we need to know? If you look at what's out there from Google Earth, there's heaps more than you need to know, and then you need the ability to, the algorithms or the people to be able to pick and choose and make sense of it. So, yeah, more data helps, but it's not always the solution.
Also, what more data is the algorithms and the analysis? Exactly. Is there a business in that for someone?
Yeah, there already is.
Yeah. In fact, Anchorage is doing some work.
With Google Earth, Global Fishing Watch. There are also now private sort of consultancies that work on developing these types of algorithms. I think this whole idea of big data is really just sort of what you can do with it or who can do what with it is really only just starting to emerge in the more public sphere. And it's starting to happen in fisheries, so there is absolutely consultancy.
We can leave it to the private sector.
There is private sector and public sector. Yeah. Google
universities is private sector.
Because once you use these algorithms, you own the algorithm, and then you own the analysis, and then you sell it. And so there is that commercialization, which isn't to say that that's not useful with the private sector, but there are these issues.
I know that the Google Earth outreach team, in partnership with some American organizations, are actually quite keen on keeping this as open source as possible. But as you rightly point out, the algorithms, I mean, someone's going to be paying for those, and it's not just your average bear that can do that sort of work. So it is going to be already limiting the types of the parties that could be doing this type of analysis.
The bigger issue to us, apart from the analysis, is the ownership and the willingness to share that information. So the information collected by the patrol boats belongs to the countries. It doesn't belong to us. They are their own sovereign assets. The information collated by the aerial surveillance is currently an issue. It has to be owned by the Commonwealth because we'll be the ones entering into a contract. But of course the FFA would like to think that they own the information. As our agriculture colleagues can tell you, the FFA has just decided to restrict the access to data information to only 30 days ahead of an operation.
So we can
a unilateral decision.
We can reduce our funding for the FFA.
We'd like to, but that's got to talk to Mr. Fisher about that.
Tim Rees, I think I read a figure somewhere that the fish consumed in the world now, only about 30% come from wild catch. Whatever that figure is. Does this mean that the Pacific is actually, you know, the major piece of the wild catch, or if you looked at the trends, if this global trend is somewhere around what I was saying, that the Wouldn't the future be that you're going to see much more aquaculture if the nations are going to survive and keep their food?
So that figure you're referring to is actually for the first time the state of fisheries and aquaculture, that biannual report that the Food and Agriculture Organization puts out. Now more than half of the world's total fish production comes from aquaculture. But overwhelmingly, a lot of that's actually in China. So those numbers are very skewed. So China is a massive producer of aquaculture. It's by far the world's largest capture fisheries fleet. They've got 34,000 distant water fishing boats. Mm-hmm. The next closest one's like 200, I think. So they're just, the scale is just off the charts. And so that really skews the global picture. I think another thing is...
And they've got a billion people as well.
Yeah, they got a couple more people than us too, so that's also something to consider. And I think too, it really depends on what type of fish you're talking about. There's been a global shift, the higher value finfish or prawns, but those are really very export driven. So you've got some countries that are really investing in export driven rather than food production for their own people. And there's a bunch of different things that go into that you might appreciate. But then you've got freshwater fisheries, so on like land-based, maybe carp aquaculture, and that's a lot more domestic market. But that sort of stuff doesn't really use quite as much as farm salmon or farm tuna, say, might do. And it's not as high value. I guess if you look at land-based agricultural systems and you think about capture fisheries as the last sort of wild harvested thing that we do, I think there's just going to have to be a natural trend towards aquaculture in some to fill some needs. But whether or not that's the sort of golden ticket to make things work, I guess if you look at large-scale agriculture, it helps some problems and created others. So it's sure. A similar situation in the oceans, just maybe about 50 years behind.
Yeah. And if we're focusing on Melanesia, the aquaculture has not taken hold well for all sorts of reasons, both cultural, logistic, etc. And if you grow the fish, you've got to be able to transport them. You need the appropriate cool storage, etc. to transport them. You've got to like the taste. You've got to know how to do your husbandry of the fish. And it really has not worked particularly well.
It's a high-risk agricultural activity. Mm. There's usually, although not a large amount of initial costs and investment, training, and you've got to be able to sustain, once you've implemented these programs, you have to be able to sustain this practice. So you can't just do a one-off training kind of thing. That being said, though, there are a lot of successful examples in Melanesia, although on a smaller scale. So I guess it really depends on what you're considering success. And are you thinking large-scale sort of export, making a global splash, then really only sort of New Caledonia, French Polynesia, with shrimp and pearl production. But you can't eat pearls, but they are pretty and they make a lot of money, you know. But Fiji has a really thriving coral aquaculture, from my last understanding, and that's for the aquarium trade. So there's a potential for the aquarium trade in the Pacific if it's well managed, but that's not food. So. It's those trade-offs, you know. Are you going to produce for food, or are you going to produce for household income,
Questions? Yes, Ashton Robinson, University of Melbourne. And I'm going to leverage a little bit off the comments on aquaculture that come back at the moment. The theme today on Security Cube, food security, biosecurity, and into fisheries, I think the difference between the fisheries aspect of what we've talked about and agriculture and biosecurity is that fisheries actually attracts foreign states' policy interventions potentially to impact on the interests of Melanesia and other Pacific states, whereas the other aspects of what we've talked about haven't. And I want to sort of just touch on that in two respects. The first is with regard, I think, to aquaculture. As Dr. Campbell mentioned, the centre of global aquaculture at the moment is in China. And the amount of aquaculture down the Chinese coast I think the last time I looked, about 9,000 aquaculture ventures of various scales. The point being, fish or prawns, or particularly fish in an aquaculture venture, have to eat something. And the concern is that there is a particularly strong Chinese emphasis on food stocks for aquaculture, and this is impacting most immediately on the krill harvest in the sub-Antarctic. That's a fair way from Melanesia. But the krill are the basis of the southern hemisphere aquatic food chain. Now, two things are driving the effect on the krill. The first is technological. Our friends the Norwegians have come up with this great ocean-going vacuum cleaner technology that basically solves the problem of how you catch krill. You can do it on an industrial scale. And secondly, that capacity, together with the market in China, has, I think, an impact on the management of the aquatic biosphere for some time to come. Now, at the moment, we've actually got some treaty blocks in place in terms of how much krill is actually harvested. I would suggest that the policy pressure coming out of China, but also out of other aquaculture countries, on the upper limits on the krill harvest needs to be watched very, very closely, particularly in the interests of broader Pacific Island countries. Now, I don't want to get into sort of which fish eat which other fish. There are several steps removed before we get into the Central Pacific. But conceptually, I think there is actually a problem here. That comes to the other end of the scale, which is the policy attention given to international negotiations and treaty structures around the management of fisheries internationally generally, such as Kamala, for example, but also other fisheries conventions, particularly on pelagic fisheries elsewhere. Very interesting. If you look at the leadership of some of the particularly Chinese and also Russian delegations that turn up, we've gone from having people who are originally food scientists, fisheries persons, or other scientific staff, and it's increasingly becoming led by international lawyers. And this is a direct foreign policy decision from distant water fishing capitals, Beijing, but other ones as well, which I suggest from this is that sort of fisheries are more likely to be a strategic foreign policy question, where we have some very powerful foreign ministries going up against some not so powerful foreign ministries in smaller fishery states, fishery island states. And I think that sort of this is a process that bears watching from an Australian foreign policy perspective, certainly, because it goes into our aid budget and all sorts of other things, and then the patrol boat program and other things as well, but also in terms of how we actually look at the food security issues of some of the countries we've been talking around here. And I do take the point that the Melanesians are probably further back on the list than, say, the Polynesian states or the Micronesians, but I think the writing's on the wall.
Anyone else want to reflect upon that? Comment?
Yeah.
BG, High Commissioner, in terms of the rather complex,
I'm sure. I'm a bit of the policies at the moment, but yeah. I had a question. I'm a bit ignorant about this technology used about aggregating devices.
Fish aggregating devices?
Yes.
There's a bunch of different kinds. I guess the one that, in that sense, was being referred to would be what's known as a nearshore fish aggregating device. And they're set within a certain distance of shore so that typically more artisanal or smaller vessels can have safer, more regular supply of fish that they wouldn't otherwise be able to catch from the shore or just from canoes. So it attracts fish that kind of hang out with tuna, and so it provides it can provide opportunities for a greater diversity of fish catch, and it's usually higher value fish as well. There's also another type of fish aggregating device known as a drifting fish aggregating device, And those aren't anchored in place like a nearshore one is. And those are set adrift usually at the high seas. Some of them can be incredibly sophisticated. Some of them have satellite tracking technology on them. And so certain foreign fishing fleets will actually go straight to these fish aggregating devices. And it's a way of reducing your search time, your fuel costs, like operational costs in general. And there's been some studies both on a smaller scale and on the for the larger industrial fleets for these types of fish aggregating devices. The nearshore ones are usually slightly easier to monitor. However, monitoring programs are not really a thing yet for a lot of countries. There are a few countries that have been doing monitoring. Niue is one of them. They've been doing a bit more of a long-term study. But the drifting fish aggregating devices actually pose a major problem to, I guess, sort of fish being that. So anytime you're aggregating, anytime you've got a fish like a tuna that aggregates around a device and it makes it easier to catch, you're kind of increasing that the vulnerability of that species to being caught. And so if you're doing this over time and it's not as monitored and you're not aware of how many there are out there, it makes it very difficult to get a good picture of what's happening in the oceans and where. So it makes it difficult to make decisions on what's your allowable catch, if you have incomplete measures of what the effort is going into this catch. And it can be made from a bunch of different materials. So you can either have something that's a raft, and the fish come and hang out underneath. You can have a buoy and a bunch of floats underneath with floaty bits, and they kind of hang out in there. So there's a whole bunch of different designs that are used, that are chosen depending on what your seafloor situation is, how far you are from shore, what type of materials are easily available to the country. It actually gets quite technical quite fast.
And you can imagine, I know Fiji's concerned about areas beyond national jurisdiction and what happens and how it impinges on resource within their boundaries. So if you started having these fads just outside of boundaries, there could be issues. And there's not really good regulation of how they're going to be used. And as soon as you get onto the high seas, it's sort of an open slather on how they might be used. And we don't understand really what the bigger implications are going to be. So when Fiji is going to the UN summit on oceans, there's a number of issues they're concerned of that they want on the agenda. One of them is these sort of issues that might occur beyond boundaries, but the external effects will come into the EEZs of these nations, potentially.
And there's a lot of talk about recognizing that this is a concern, but there's really no sort of coordinated strategy. To my knowledge, but it has come up in the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission a number of times, specifically small island developing states, because it just poses such a massive management challenge to them, and it's usually just waterborne fishing fleets that are using those drifting fads. So again, I emphasize that nearshore fads and drifting fads are very different and used for similar but different reasons.
Nearshore, there's been issues with some of the customary landowners because, of course, if you put them nearshore and you aggregate the fish, the customary knowledge about where fish are, which gives the advantage to the local villages and the community and their food security, can begin to be overridden. And then adjacent communities that do have rights to fish traditionally across the area, but get an advantage. And so we have had in Solomon Islands where they've destroyed the fish aggregating devices the communities have, because they just feel there's something not quite right about it, or it doesn't fit with custom and their guardianship of the fish in that area. So there's a lot of issues, and they do have some development benefits, but there's issues that need to be worked through when we think about these things with customary owners or the local people really
being
located.
And to add to that, I think then I guess the attractive thing to development assistance initiatives about fish aggregating devices is something tangible, it's something you can see. So you can say, gave 10 fish aggregating devices to Fiji, tick. But what hasn't been done as well is integrating this into a program. So you can teach people how to deploy, you can teach people how to maintain, but what hasn't been focused on, which is part of the reason why there's this vandalism that occurs, is this consultation at the community level. It's one thing for the Ministry of Fisheries to say this is a great plan, but then if you're messing with the access the local system, even if you've got tenure where it's sort of open access, if you put a FAD out in front of a village, it's their FAD. And then you're creating, even within a village, you can create conflict where you had people that were rich enough to have motorized vehicles or motorized vessels, and so they had a competitive advantage in their fisheries market because they could go out farther and find these fish. Well, now you have canoe fishermen who can row out and catch these same fish. And so sometimes you've got these cases where you've got the motorized vessel owners coming out and cutting the FADs because they want that advantage back. So it's incredibly complex.
Judy, earlier in the day, I can't remember who it was, but someone was reflecting that our Australian-Pacific cooperation around defence had been working very well, and perhaps had some lessons for those of us in agriculture and in food security. And I liked your language about being a partner of choice. Now, I wonder how often that happens in the agriculture and food security world, where we, Australia, are a partner of choice. It's something to aspire to. What's your secret?
I think the success of the patrol boat program is it is about engaging with the countries and sort of building our opportunities to work with them and influence things that might be in our mutual interests. Having staff there is a big difference. In some countries, the only Australians in country are the two naval personnel. But we work very cooperatively with them. We have annual talks. So I just came back from Samoa, that we have annual talks with all 12 of our countries, and we sit down and we talk about the little things that they want, the big things that they want, and we talk about whether or not we can provide them a defence cooperation program. And I think, yeah, just trying to be sort of appreciative that this is a partnership, and that we do things slowly and cooperatively at a speed with which they're comfortable. I think is how we have managed the patrol program, and it's gone extremely well. Having said that, you know, I guess we would like to be the primary security partner of choice. In this world, that's not likely. You know, China, Russia, other countries, extremely active in the Pacific, and that's good and good for the countries, as long as we're all coordinated and we all know what we're doing and we're not overwhelming the Pacific Island countries or tripping over each other. That's sort of, I guess, now our best approach, and complementing what we're doing.
Can I ask a question flipping that? I mean, ACR is quite popular choice as a partner throughout Melanesia, and I wonder if there's lessons from ACR that you think might be given to coastal fisheries in that engaging at the community level, getting community-based science and adaptive management that one might transfer from ACR's experience into the fishery world. And I think you do have some fisheries.
Oh yeah, we do.
I'd be interested in your insight in this type of engagement.
Well, like everything else, it's about relationships and sustaining them through time. We're in Myanmar next week, and they say, well, we want to work with you because you were here during the hard times. Mm-hmm. So we've been in Myanmar for 30 years non-stop. Mm-hmm. And so we're a preferred partner in Myanmar, even though it's a gold rush there at the moment with everyone else trying to come in. They want to partner with ASEAN. So, and that's the same in fisheries work as well. And if you do it in a participatory way and you build capacity, local capacity, and you sustain those relationships through time, and you have sufficient continuity in your own staff so they can build up those personal relationships, then you do become a preferred partner.
I think that's certainly true for defence. You know, and sadly, it's a very cyclone and disaster-ridden area. So. Australia and New Zealand often are the very first people to respond to those things and lead the responses and do it in a way that respects the country's requirements. We don't say what we think they should do, we just wait for their requests and politely respond. But we, through thick and thin, I think that's the
but in our case, two of our RPMs have lived and worked in the Pacific for extended periods of time and are well known in those countries. And have occupied senior positions in those countries, so that also helps.
Just noting the presentation, I think Meg, climate change shifting tuna away from Melanesia, the huge cost of illegal fishing, piracy. You know, our position on climate change, how does that fit with the Pacific? And, you know, is there an active interaction on that front? And also how we talked about a partnership surveillance role for Australia. Does that need some different approach or enhancement or that?
I think with climate change, I think everybody knows there was a bit of a fraught relationship there as we went into the Paris Agreement, etc. But the reality is Australia probably does more than any other country for adaptation in the Pacific. It has a number of programs that are trying to build resilience work with the Pacific Islanders, and we support their regional agencies that are very active in this space. I think the lesson from that, though, when we come into oceans, which I'm interested to see how it evolves, but when you analyze what happened in climate change, and Australia didn't give the support that they wanted for emissions targets, etc., they built, Pacific Islands built new alliances and stuck to what they felt was a survival issue, put it on the international agenda. If they couldn't work with us, they worked with a different UN group, Pacific Island Development Group. They worked with AOSIS, they worked with G7. They pushed and pushed to get it on the agenda. And I'm interested to see, when we talk about partnerships, is with the SDG on oceans and this UN Ocean Summit. This is another survival issue, I think, for the Pacific. It's incredibly important. They've played a leadership role. And I think there is a real possibility for us to play a stronger role in getting it on the international agenda. And quite frankly, we have a common interest there. Good oceans management is good for us as well in terms of our large ocean spaces.
But it's easy to get distracted here if you listen to Minister Bishop's keynote at the Aid conference last week at the ANU. She couldn't have been stronger about climate change and Australia's leadership role in the region. We're chairing the Green Climate Fund, and we're now the CEO of the Green Climate Fund, and we've tried very hard to get an extra allocation of money for the Pacific for the Green Climate Fund. So, and certainly the Minister's directions to us to be to play a very proactive role in assisting our partner countries in the region to work out how best to meet their nationally determined contributions to the Paris Agreement, and to deploy as much Australian science as we can into the region to help both in adaptation and mitigation. And we'll certainly be doing that.
And as I say, we're probably the most active in the region with adaptation. We will have to play a key role to help the island countries access those enormous amounts of money and make sure there are specific channels to.
Now, there certainly appears to be a disconnect with the current energy policy debate in Australia, but that shouldn't be seen to be derail what we're doing substantively on climate change in the region.
And CSIRO has been doing a lot of research on modelling Pacific climate systems as well, and it's working pretty closely with the Pacific community on that front. And the FAME division, Pacific community, sorry, I can't remember the acronym, but it's the Oceanic Fisheries. So they're working pretty heavily on trying to get a better picture of where this projected shift in tuna is going to go and what that means, and just trying to get better data out of it. So that when countries are asking, like, do I need to be, like, stocking my larder now, or what's going to happen, what do I need to be doing, there is that information base starting to be built there for some of that decision making.
And for coastal fisheries, now they're trying to do that modeling, and that's just started out very recently.
Yeah, there's been some broad brush modeling done up at the University of British Columbia on just general trends and shifts up in the poles and stuff, but, yeah.
As opposed to in the Pacific, working with countries about what some of this means for them. And therefore you can start to take proactive action if you understand how it's going to affect, you know, are you going to lose your coral bleaching, for instance, your coral reef system? What will that have effect on your productivity of fisheries on which you are dependent? What measures could you take? And if you can't take enough, then what alternatives are there? And so we have to have some of those ideas. And that's where the most recent Pacific Community and FFA report cards are saying really short of good data that's at a scale that can help management for these countries. And that's what they're trying to plug.
Mm-hmm. And I think that acidification point raised this morning is an absolute, that's a time bomb.
And just on the illegal fishing aspect that you mentioned, I was interested in, is that a priority in our defence cooperation program with our Pacific partnerships?
Illegal fishing?
Yes.
In as much as it impacts on the white paper and the security and stability, economic stability of the region as well as security of the region, we provide the asset to them to build their capability to enforce their own fishing laws and that sort of thing, but I mean, for defence, like, we don't collect fishing data, for example, illegal fishing data, but we're certainly interested in its potential to be used for other security concerns.
Just a couple of observations. One was about the satellite surveillance of the EEZ. You may be aware that there was an NGO from the US that wanted to offer us free surveillance of our EEZ, but we could read in between the lines and understood what it was intended for. This is just when the Russians were very close to us, the Pacific, just a short view. But there's also the issue about the sovereign airspace above you. Many of the Pacific nations have got that as an issue. This is our space, so you cannot, you know. But when you look at the other issues we just talked about, see, the Pacific is a very, very small agenda for Australia. It is an important agenda, but it has got, you know, the Asian front. You know, at the moment, there's a huge push towards Indonesia, China, Vietnam. All of that seems to be where the growth and the future growth of Australia will come from. That's the reason you have, you know, the Territory White Paper out. If you read between the lines there, you'll see that it's designed purely to service the North. I realize that at DFAT, you know, the Pacific Division is one of the largest because it has so many little islands and, you know, the big team behind that looking out for us. But coming to the climate change situation, I can appreciate, you know, what the Australian agenda is. In COP 21, it was Obama who said we must be supporting, we should support, and that's when the Australian tone changed, and he went into supporting and endorsing the agreement. But now with Donald there and his direction, I'm not sure where it's going to go in the future. So I still fear that there could be a change in tone and direction with Australia with its policy, because it's pressure with, like, the energy story on one side and the new coined word of fake news, and now clean coal. You know, I mean, what I'm saying is that it's a concern for the Pacific.
Yeah.
And it is something that I think US, the scientists, US, the you know, people with a vision should be pursuing. And I think it's important that the decision makers up in the Parliament House understand that we need to be following a strategy.
Thank you very much. Yeah, maybe a final reflection from
Isabel Powell. Yeah, look, if I can just reiterate, the Defence White Paper mentions three objectives. Two of those have to do with the Pacific. So I would probably challenge your idea for defence anyway, that within defence, the Pacific is our number one security area of interest and our area to capacity build. The PNSP alone is $2 billion over 30 years. We haven't given anywhere near that to any other region in the world. The Pacific represents to us an area of intense need for stability, economic stability, security, human security, or every aspect. So we devote a lot of attention to that area to build capacity. So our gifting of the patrol boats, our gifting of the aerial capability to provide air surveillance, and again, that would have to be with each country's permission to do flyover, absolutely. Is a way of us building capability in the Pacific. We don't want to do what we shouldn't do, but we would like to help our neighbours be able to do what they would like to be able to do. So we very much build the Defence Cooperation Program around the structure of partnership, capacity building, definitely not doing. And I think that's something that we're being very successful in. But I appreciate your point. The Pacific is a huge region, and I think people call them, you know, small island states, but they're actually large water states.
Yes.
And there are significant interest in the issue for us.
Megan, did you have a final reflection?
I didn't have many reflections, but I think when you look at fisheries in the Pacific, there's a lot of opportunity there, but everything's just sitting there on the cusp, and we see that with the tuna reports, we see it with the coastal fisheries. If we don't act now, the development implications are huge, and the security implications for people, their lives, and the nation's economies are really big. But we have made, if you look at all the report cards and the assessments, the momentum is beginning, and we just have to keep pushing with it and make those partnerships work. And there's a lot there, I think, that has a lot of potential, and in some ways it's more inspiring than many other areas of development in the Pacific. And it's a place where we can partner constructively, and we have the common interest, so it's something we can build on. So I think there's a lot of potential, but we have to harvest it. It's not going to happen on its own.
I'm sure I was one of the least educated people in the room before, so I feel that my knowledge and capacity has grown greatly, and I've been really heartened to see the sort of connections that have been made throughout the day, hearing conversations, hearing the sharing that have gone on, so we really appreciate it. Now, in terms of going forward, we've had a few queries for people who'd like to see the slides. They were great slides. So we'll put them up on our website. Can I check our speakers here? Happy to have slides as well? Great, okay. So we'll have those up on the website on internationalaffairs.org.au fairly soon. We'll also put up the recording of the event. That might take a little bit longer if you've got to download it and upload it at, you know, Australian internet speed. So I'm not promising that straight away, but we will get that up as soon as we can. We'll also be running some pieces on this in Australian Outlook, the Australian Institute of International Affairs, very popular blog. We get up to 29,000 unique visitors per month. And I'm going to say, for any of the people who presented who might want to turn what they said into a full 800 word piece, we'd be very interested in hearing from you. So really, for me, the only thing left is to give some thanks to thanks for the corporate fund. We've really enjoyed working with the corporate fund and all of its board and staff and the wonderful director who is going to sorely miss when he sits down. I'd like to thank my own team at the Australian Institute of International Affairs. So thank Susan Kim and all the funders for all of their wonderful work. And last and not at all least, I'd like to thank Jim Ingram. So, former director of ADAB, former director of the World Food Programme, whose vision it was, a very kind donation made this possible. So, we want to leave the final words to him. So, Jim, if you'd like to come close to me.
It's a bit tricky now.
It's a really tricky setup.
I want to get up there, I'll fall over. This is safer. Thank you very much, Melissa. At the end of the day, I'd have to say that I'm very pleased with the result. Not that there is any result, but in the sense that the worth of bringing together a broad degree of expertise in relation to what is a very complex subject, as everybody has said. Its complexity has in fact been revealed even more than perhaps I certainly realised beforehand. Perhaps I should say that why I wanted to do this was first of all because my two favourite organisations are the Crawford Fund and the Australian Institute of International Affairs. And I'd like to take this opportunity, actually, to... I don't know where Melissa's got to. I'd like to say that I've had a lot to do with both of these organisations over a long period, years, 25 years at least. And both Melissa and Dennis have in fact brought both organisations to a level of success, prominence and funding, every other criterion of success, and they both have been outstanding, absolutely outstanding. The reason for having this kind of gathering, I suppose, is to try and reduce the curse of the Western world, namely more and more specialization, less and less interaction. And as we've seen today in relation to a small area of the world, relatively speaking, the way in which so many of the different disciplines here have not really spoken to one another. And unless they do, our disappointment, if I may say so, with the success of the classic development assistance model will continue. I believe it is a model which needs revision. Don't ask me how to revise it, but I don't think it is any longer. Perhaps become more politicized in some ways than it was earlier. I think some of the, I won't be particular, and certainly not rude, but I have a feeling that quite a few of the programs in the South Pacific are really deep down intended to benefit Australia rather more than the recipient countries. So I think discussions today have revealed indeed that the silos are, there are more silos than we perhaps, at least I imagined, and their connections are very much needed to be strengthened in some way or another. These, one of the, our colleague from Fiji, the High Commissioner, said something very important, I thought, when he said that our aid people interact with, you might say, the elites of Fiji. Those elites themselves, if I understood him correctly, don't understand really the mentality of the rural people whom the Australians and the Fijian government are trying to help. So, in other words, silos are not just between various disciplines, but they exist within the countries you try to help themselves. And that, I think, explains why so many aid interventions have been disappointing. Not even though there's a great deal of idealism and competence brought to bear in their implementation. Being an old man, I'm frightened I'll go on really reminisce, which would take up a lot of time. So I'll refrain from that, but simply say that my first acquaintance with the South Pacific, professionally, so to speak, was in 1947, 70 years ago. That's when the South Pacific Commission, I don't know if it's still called that, was created by the Canberra Agreement. The very same themes of coordination, even then, were raised as have been raised here. So I leave you with those thoughts, and our thanks again, my thanks in particular, to Melissa and Dennis and all the staff who backed them up in bringing about this successful occasion. Thank you very much.